You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Hello, and thank you for joining. My name is Elizabeth Murray, and I am a senior program officer in the Africa Center at the United States Institute of Peace. Together with the Peace Appeal Foundation, USIP is pleased to host today's virtual event to share expertise from our series of case studies on national dialogues. Our recent publication, National Dialogues in Peacebuilding and Transitions, Creativity and Adaptive Thinking, explores dialogues held between 2008 and 2015 in Kenya, Central African Republic, Senegal, Lebanon, Tunisia, and Yemen. These six national dialogues came about amidst conflict, political deadlock, or transitions, but the specific context in which they arose are very diverse. They're likewise very diverse in the forms that they took. We have a great lineup of speakers for you today who will walk us through some of the lessons from these processes. And today's event is broken into two panels, and each panel will explore three dialogues. In both panels, we will see short, pre-recorded videos from three of the case experts, and then hear a discussant who will share some reflections on what he or she has heard and ask some questions of our experts before we move to the audience Q&A. For our live viewers, we ask that you please submit questions using the chat box on USIP's event page, and we also encourage you to tweet about this event using hashtag National Dialogues. Our first panel, which will begin in just a few minutes here, will delve into inclusion, the question of who participated in the dialogue and why these decisions were made. And our experts will reflect on whether the dialogues had any long-term impact in broadening who is at the table for important conversations about a country. Our second panel, which will be moderated by Susan Sagant, will explore the role of the international community in national dialogues and how international support and diplomacy can best be leveraged to meet the needs around national dialogues. The publication that we're discussing today took a long and winding road to completion. We began the project several years ago amidst tons of enthusiasm within the international community about national dialogues. And there was a sense that these processes had tremendous, perhaps unprecedented promise to resolve longstanding conflicts and to make societies more inclusive. And there was particularly great enthusiasm around these large, very inclusive national dialogues that would bring hundreds of people from all stakeholder groups to the table to discuss a broad agenda. And while we at USIP appreciated the promise in this highly inclusive model, we also believed that there was a lot of value in exploring smaller dialogues and their potential to broker agreement, particularly around thorny issues. And so we specifically included in our cases several national dialogues that didn't fit this large, very open model. We included several dialogues that were smaller, elite-level affairs. And in observing a range of cases, we've seen that the organizers of national dialogues often have to navigate a tension between being pragmatic in pursuit of a quick agreement and striving for the broader inclusion that can bring about longer-term change in who has a seat at the table in a given country. In the videos that we will see now, Penda Ba discusses the striking inclusivity that characterized Yassis Nationale processes in Senegal and the long-term impacts more than 10 years after the conclusion. Dan Brumberg will discuss Tunisia's national dialogue, essentially an elite affair, but one that facilitated agreements among a divided political class. And Aliyah Bouaoun explores Lebanon's national dialogues and how the power-sharing system there impacted inclusivity. Let me say a few words about our experts before we start our pre-recorded videos. Dr. Imam Penda Ba is an associate professor in political sciences at Gastenberger University and a scientific director of the PhD program on political science. She also co-authored the USIP case study on Senegal's Assise Nationale. Her research interests include public policy, particularly on education, gender, and religion. Dr. Dan Brumberg. Daniel Brumberg is a professor in the Department of Government and the Director of Democracy and Governance Studies at Georgetown University. He's a former senior advisor at USIP and a current senior non-resident fellow at the Arab Center. And Dan authored the Tunisia case study in USIP's publication. And Dr. Aliyah Boone is the Director of Middle East and North Africa Programs at USIP. He joined USIP after serving as the Executive Director of the Arab Human Rights Fund. Prior to this, he led the Danish Refugee Council's program in Iraq. And Ali authored the Lebanon case study. So if we could please roll the videos now. Thank you.
The Assises Nationales of Senegal were held from 2008 to 2009. It was the most innovative and inclusive deliberative exercise in the contemporary political history of the country. The trigger for this event was the presidential election of February 2007, which former President Abdoulaye Wade won in the first round. The opposition denied the results, and the situation led to an extreme polarization of the political field. All dialogue between the government and the opposition were broken, and among other decisions, the latter decided to boycott the legislative and senatorial elections. In fact, the electoral crisis was just the tip of the iceberg because Senegal was in a turmoil of a multidimensional crisis that was ethical, political, economic, social, and cultural for several years already. To understand and overcome the crisis, the opposition initiated this very unique participative process and were soon joined by all components of the society. Nearly 200 issues organized into 14 themes were discussed, going from economic, culture, politics, governance, education, health, religion, infrastructure, energy, ethics, justice, and even the conflict in the Casamance region. The most famous output of the Assises is the Charter of Democratic Governance, signed by 234 stakeholders, that summarizes the main conclusions of the national dialogue. The first impact of the Assises Nationales is that this national dialogue reshaped Senegalese democracy by placing citizens at the center of the decision-making process and the making of public policies. This is a very paradigmatic shift from a long past, a colonial and post-colonial past, where decisions were taken by a very small political and economic elite and its international allies. Even if Senegal used to vote since the 19th century, the Assises Nationales marked a turning point towards a democracy centered on citizens. The Assises designed then new ways for elaborating and implementing public policies in which citizens' voices and participations and evaluation are mandatory. The second impact can be the promotion of the country's national languages. And this is a very strong and a very symbolic point because for the first time in our modern history, discussions around domestic and international issues are held in the native languages of the citizens. And even the Charter of Democratic Governance was available not only in French and English, but also in the six national languages that are Djola, Malinke, Pula, Sere, Soninke, and Wolof. And this is the first time, again, that such dignity has been given to the vernacular languages. And maybe last point, it was all the process was done relying on national and voluntary contributions. Senegal democracy has always been captured by a urban and French-speaking intellectual elite, and the vast majority of the population has been excluded from the exercise of power, except during electoral period. This is one of the main reasons of the lack of identification of the people with the state. The Assises tried to correct this gap between the people and the state by inviting all components of the country, private sector, politicians, civil society, NGOs, trade unions, experts, religious people, academic people, ordinary citizens, men, women, young people, they all gather in all cities, in rural areas, but also in the diaspora, and particularly in Paris, New York, and Toronto. Two bodies have been set up for these discussions, what they call thematic committees and the citizens' consultations. The two bodies together allowed the widest possible participation and the co-production of knowledge and recommendation for Senegalese future trajectory. The main lesson we can draw from the Assise Nationale is that peace and stability in the country are linked to a permanent dialogue and inclusion of the citizens in the decision-making process. For the most part, the conclusions of the Assise Nationale have not been implemented by the regime of Abdoulaye Wade or that of the current president, Macky Sall. Senegal has unfortunately experienced several riots in 2011 and 2021, which killed dozens of people. The claim in all these riots were linked to a more economic justice, respect of the constitution and rule of law, and governance respectful of the values of Senegalese society. It is precisely these points that were widely debated during the Assise Nationale. My personal conviction is that an essential part of the solutions to our problems are found in the conclusion of this Assise, and we have to go back to these conclusions.
Well, the Tunisian National Dialogue emerged in the spring of 2013 as a response to two interrelated problems. First, the failure of the Constituent Assembly to produce consensus on a new constitution, which would provide the foundation for a new democratic Tunisia. And the second failure, or the second challenge, in fact, was rising Islamist violence on the one side and the assassination of two secular leaders on the other, which really led to a situation in which secular leaders were prepared to boycott the whole process and the thing looked like it was going to fall apart. The other issue that helped to create the dialogue in a kind of ironic way was the coup d'etat in Egypt in July 2013, which generated similar fears of a coup in Tunisia and really impelled the leaders to find a way to make peace. The dialogue was led by the Tunisian General Labor Union, the UGTT, in concert with three other organizations, civil society organizations. They created what was called the Quartet, and they led the effort to negotiate among political elites a new sort of consensus that would then allow for a constitution and a roadmap forward. Well, Tunisia's national dialogue was the only successful national dialogue really in the history of the Arab world. And it was successful in a key way. First of all, it prevented a collapse of the transition itself. And that itself was a success. Given the alternative, which was civil conflict and perhaps civil war, the dialogue stopped that from happening, and that was critical. The other thing that the dialogue did was provide an instrument by which key issues that had been debated and fought over regarding a new constitution were resolved. Questions that dealt with and were highly linked to the question of Islamist secular conflict, they came up, the participants in the dialogue came up with various solutions, and they were incorporated into the constitution, and that itself. Without that, it is possible that the constitution wouldn't have been created in the first place. And the third thing that the dialogue really accomplished was creating a roadmap, not only for the new constitution, but also for elections. This was a matter of hot political dispute. The resignation of the Islamist-led government in Ennahda was a prerequisite. The modalities around that negotiation were eventually negotiated, and the leaders came up with a roadmap that really allowed the transition to take place. Those are all the positive sort of outcomes. The negative outcome, in some sense, was part of the positive. The transition itself was based on a consensus-based government. Everybody had to agree, so nobody really did agree. And this focus on consensus has served as an impediment to moving to a more majoritarian kind of government in Tunisia. So the very success of the dialogue also generated its own very serious challenges in the years forward. But in the main, it was a great success. So how did the national dialogue in Tunisia expand room for representation and participation? It really did it in two interesting ways. The first thing has to be said that the dialogue allowed for the return of political leaders that had been linked to the ancien regime, the previous regime. And those leaders had really not been part of the political dialogue, but had they been excluded, they might have opposed it and sabotaged the whole transition. So the dialogue created space by which these leaders from the previous regime, one of whom eventually becomes president, to participate in creating the new democratic Tunisia. And the other thing that the dialogue did as well, it involved civil society organizations and gave them some space. But it has to be said at the end of the day, those civil society organizations were not, aside from those four in the quartet that managed the dialogue, newer, younger civil society groups were really not critical to the success of the dialogue. It was an elite enterprise, and it involved an expansion of the nature and political diversity of the elite that gave the whole process more legitimacy and more inclusion, but ultimately ensured that what was an elite enterprise. So what lessons can we learn from the Tunisian dialogue? I think that there are several interesting lessons. First of all, let's keep in mind that every dialogue is unique, and Tunisia had its unique aspects. And one was that the UGTT, the labor union, was both a key mediator of the dialogue and at the same time a protagonist and antagonist in the whole drama. And it used its capacity to mobilize and threaten the other members of the dialogue to manage it. That is a very unusual situation that's probably not easily replicated and helped to create success. And I just think it's important to recognize that. But there are broader lessons beyond what is unique to Tunisia that are worth keeping in mind. And one is dialogues cannot have an overloaded agenda. They have to be focused. The issues that have to be addressed have to be limited in nature. And if you have too many people, too many groups, too many issues, you're going to get the potential for a collapse very quickly. So the genius, if you like, of the Tunisia dialogue was that it was in fact limited. It had a number of issues to resolve, and it struck a crucial balance, and this is important, between the need for autonomy and the need for being hived off from the political arena, and at the same time for the need for input. And getting that sweet spot between the need for autonomy and the need for engagement was something that they did pretty good job of. And that's a lesson for all national dialogues in the Middle East and beyond.
There were four rounds of dialogue in Lebanon between 2006 and 2012, the four of them happened in different contexts and for different reasons. The first one happened in 2006. It was mostly about the Syrian-Lebanese relations in the aftermath of Hariri's assassination, as well as the problematic issue of the weapons of Hezbollah. In 2008, it was completely different because back then there was an acute political crisis between the pro-Hezbollah and anti-Hezbollah political forces around the issue of the private telecommunication network that the party was maintaining in Lebanon. And obviously, Hezbollah considered this as a matter of direct threat to its leadership and its operations in Lebanon. In 2009, the main issue, the dialogue did not happen because of a crisis. It happened as one of the first things that President Suleiman undertook as he became president of Lebanon. And in 2012, the dialogue was mostly driven by the conflict in nearby Syria and the role that Lebanon should be playing in this conflict, whether it's a neutral role or an active role. I think it's unfair to say that the dialogues did not have an impact at all, but it's also inaccurate to say that they had a durable impact. So basically, the way I would qualify it is that each of these four rounds of dialogues had a partial impact that resulted in unblocking a crisis, the crisis that triggered the dialogue, basically, without addressing the longer-term issues that were causing these political crises. So in 2006, the main output was some sort of an agreement on how the International Tribunal for Lebanon should be set up, as well as an agreement that Lebanon should request Syria to accept diplomatic representation in both countries. In 2008, obviously, the situation was more problematic because we had the military invasion of the capital. And the role that the Qataris played back then was instrumental in maintaining the ceasefire, but also brokering a short-term political agreement that resulted in legislative elections, as well as appointing a new president of the republic. In 2009, there was no tangible result of the dialogue because it was cut short by the legislative elections that happened that year. And in 2012, actually, there was a document that basically asserted Lebanon's neutral role in Syria's conflict. And on paper, the text looked really great. However, it was known from the beginning that complying with the requirements of this document would be very difficult for the various political forces in Lebanon. But the output was a nice document about how Lebanon should look at the regional conflicts in general, and more specifically, the Syrian conflict. The four rounds of dialogue did not really have a huge impact on the political representation or political inclusion in Lebanon, in general in Lebanon. And the reason is that because of the power sharing system in Lebanon, the dialogue participants had always to be selected among the 10 or 15 most important political leaders or leaderships in Lebanon. So if you look at the four rounds of dialogue, you would see 70 or 80% of the participants being the same or representing more or less the same political forces, with very few changes happening between one round and the other, adding a couple of personalities here or removing a couple of others from there. So there was not really a significant change in who is taking part in these dialogues and who is who's basically having a role around this table. What is worth noting, however, is two things. The first one is an attempt by the French government to call for a dialogue in Paris, to which they invited two representatives of civil society organizations. That was a first in Lebanon's modern history. And the second one is a parallel track that was started by a UNDP-funded project called the Common Space Initiative, that became later on an independent organization helping in national dialogue. In terms of lessons learned, I guess the first important lesson is that in the case of Lebanon, it's always important to have an external facilitator or mediator involved in convening and facilitating dialogues. And this probably is due to the power sharing system in Lebanon. The second one is about addressing the longer term issue, causing a political crisis on top of addressing the immediate ones that triggered the dialogue. And the third one is about political representation. It's a reality that in Lebanon, the power sharing system requires, working with and through specific political leaders or parties or structures. But at the same time, we need to be creative in how we ensure that other emerging or youth political leaders are also included in these political processes.
Great. Thank you to our experts for recording these outstanding videos. You covered so much ground in just 6 minutes each. And thank you so much to our AV team for working with us to produce them. There are so many insights that I'm very eager to explore, and I hope that our live audience is as well. We encourage you again to submit questions using the chat box on USIP's event page. But before we get to your questions, I'm pleased to introduce Derek Brown, who will serve as our discussant for today. Derek is co-executive director of the Peace Appeal Foundation, which is USIP's partner organization for this event. Prior to joining the Peace Appeal Foundation in 2005, Derek was the vice president and associate chair of Ashoka, Innovators for the Public. Derek was also previously a USIP Jennings Randolph Fellow. Derek has written and advised widely on national dialogue processes, so we're very eager for his insights. He's going to go ahead and offer some reflections on what he's seen in the videos and ask a few questions of our panelists. Derek, over to you.
Thanks very much, Elizabeth, and thanks to our distinguished panelists for their insights and their work, and obviously to USIP for hosting the events. So I have a few initial comments on the cases presented, and then I'm going to ask the panelists to opine on a few questions that I have before we turn to the audience. I mean, as you've heard, each of these three processes is very different in their purpose and their structure and their outcomes. They arise in very different political contexts with varying degrees of conflict and threats of violence. I would say that two strike me as having served primarily as vehicles for managing distinct and immediate political crises, while the third attempted to address systemic challenges in the wake of a contested national election, that being Senegal's. Tunisia's national dialogue is perhaps the best known of all these cases, and it's generally perceived as the most successful. It really sought to pull the nation back from the brink, establishing a national dialogue process to implement a contested transition. Senegal as a Assises Nationale, arising in the wake of a contested election, really sought to do something much more ambitious even. It was seeking not only to change policy, but to change a national political culture dominated by urban elites, as Penda noted. But Lebanon's national dialogue experience reflects the complicated confessional politics that Ely cited that continue to paralyze the country today. In that context, where the country periodically comes to crises that threatens to spin out of control, their national dialogues, plural, really served as safety valves, really a formal mechanism to support communications among party elites, which, if even if limited, are still somewhat more inclusive than the lack of contact or just bilateral exchanges. And this really gets to the point about inclusivity and representation, which is inclusivity is always a matter of degree. In terms of thinking about a broader context, what strikes me about the Senegal process is that it really fits our classic notion of what we think inclusivity and increased representation might be, and that it engaged literally, you know, hundreds of ordinary citizens, the diaspora, the business community, in a way that was really quite remarkable. Whereas Lebanon's process was limited. It was an elite negotiation by and large. It had from 15 to 19 stakeholders. But as Ely cited, there were attempts to bring in other actors. And even just with 15 to 19 political stakeholders at the table, that is more inclusive than a lot of the bilateral one-to-one, party-to-party conversations that had taken place. So I think we need to keep that context of inclusivity in that broader frame. Similarly with Tunisia, I really appreciate Dan's comments about how though it was largely an elite negotiation, that there was a way in which it drew important actors who could have served as spoilers. And so when we think about inclusivity, I would just encourage us to make sure that we're thinking about it in the broadest terms. I mean, how does it fit the appropriate context? I think another area of particular interest that comes out of these cases is the interplay of a range of different strategies for promoting political change, engaging multiple types of actors, both among the process and within some of the processes. So the things that I've heard in reading the case studies and in the presentations we just heard, the strategies range from sort of formal negotiations, which I would not describe as dialogue as such, consultative processes, a genuine consensus or largely consensus-based dialogue. There have been mass mobilization that was employed, street protests. There were back-channel talks, even diplomatic efforts, and regional pressure in the case of Lebanon. And all of these sort of added to the ability for some impact to be achieved, although we'll be talking about impact and the limits of that later. All of these processes, whether in the official dialogue itself or in the parallel efforts that were cited, provided opportunities for that wider engagement. And we really, I think that's one of the things that we want to examine further as we go forth. The question here is, did that inclusion have a lasting impact, or did it just serve an immediate purpose? And if not, why not? And what can we learn? Another interesting common element that comes out of these that strikes me in the cases is the apparent success of the convening of each of these national dialogue processes and how their structure from convening to the state, bringing the particular stakeholders who came together, serve the process to a greater or lesser extent. Senegal's journey to the Cise Nationale was conceptualized by the opposition, but then turned over to civil society who implemented. And civil society made the brilliant choice in choosing a very respected convener, who nonetheless was never ever fully successful in having that process rise above its association as an opposition process. Lebanon's convening was different at different rounds, arising in 2008 out of a regional conference in Doha that was set up to defuse a crisis. The Doha Agreement charged the new incoming president, Suleiman, with relaunching a national dialogue. Yet even as a compromise candidate as a president, Suleiman's credibility as a dialogue convener was damaged over time, both as he attempted to enter electoral politics in Lebanon, which is not what the president's supposed to do, and in subsequent elections, and as the how we manage the process. Tunisia's convening is perhaps the most interesting, as Dan has noted. It raises important questions as the nominal convener, the quartet, led by the UGTT, was both a convener and a protagonist. And the circumstance that led to these different convening models and structures raise important questions about how power is exercised, both by the conveners themselves and as a source of influence for the conveners and for the ability of the dialogue process to make progress. For conveners as well as the process, reputation is a source of power. Amadou Makhdar Mabou seems to have had the reputation that allowed those who directly participated in the dialogue as well as the general public to have a degree of confidence in the Cise Nationale. In Lebanon, Suleiman's power was more that of his office, and it was much more contested. Whereas UGTT and the quartet had varying degrees of reputational power, but also, most importantly, they had the influence rooted in a membership of over 600,000 people in the union. I guess my final comments before I turn over to our panelists relates to the question of impact and whether these dialogues are perceived as successful. I would say in international circles, there's been a tendency of late to be skeptical of national dialogues, of seeing gaps between their very ambitious goals and what they delivered. Yet at a national level, we see increasing calls for national dialogue to serve as a possible vehicle for transforming deeply entrenched conflicts. These calls for national dialogue resonate with the increasing interest by scholars and activists alike in the last decades in a more inclusive deliberative democracy through the structure, though the structure of national dialogues usually lack the representative characteristics of formal legislative bodies. I think Pendabah's comment suggesting that the Cise Nationale's contribution or lesson may be the importance of permanent dialogue as means of connecting people to the state seems to attest to this, which is not to neglect the critical importance of national dialogues as mechanisms for crisis management, whether seeking in short term to avoid disaster or to transform systems. I think at the end of the day, the perceptions of impact must be locally determined, as these cases exemplify. What's common among Senegal, Tunisia, and Lebanon examples is the remarkable degree to which they were locally rooted and determined with very little external involvement. So with those initial comments, I'd like to turn to our panelists and use the discussant's prerogative to ask a few questions. I guess maybe my first questions would be for Penda, you, and for Dan. I'm hoping the two of you could in turn respond to the following. What were the main sources of power that allowed the processes to achieve the influences that they did? And where did this power fall short? And what lessons, if any, would these hold? Penda, do you want to start us off on that? Or would I think you're
Can you ask again the question,
please? Yeah, could you say what were the sources of power that allowed the Cise Nationale to achieve the influence that it did? And where did this power and influence fall short?
Okay. I think that what happened in 2008 in Senegal is that we have this kind of great and massive consensus on that we were in a deep crisis. You know, I think that the whole population and even the rulers acknowledged that fact, that we were at a kind of breaking point and that things were not working at all. And remember that we are in this Sahel region where, you know, Ivory Coast were in crisis, Mali not yet, but would be very soon, etc. So this consensus on the fact that we were having maybe one of our major crises lead people to go and the fact that also all these segments of the society, economic component of the population, the political parties, NGOs, people abroad, etc. I think that it worked like a big pressure on people to go and do something. I think that the idea was that something were to be done before a kind of collapse in the society.
Thank you. Dan, do you want to weigh in on the Tunisian experience in that regard?
Yeah, and the Tunisian experience was also in some way brought about by a crisis. That's a similar sort of story. You mentioned that, Derek. I think that the key point here is the UGTT, which was the leading member of the quartet and the real convener, had tremendous legitimacy as the largest sort of nationalist organization convened before at different moments in Tunisian political crises. So there's an ample precedent for this organization sort of taking the lead. It has the kind of national credibility that no organization in Tunisia can match, and that's really important. And of course, as you said, they were able to mobilize, and they were always willing to mobilize their leaders, their followers rather, if in fact the parties didn't agree. And that really meant if in fact the Islamist party and Ennahda didn't agree to the terms demanded by the quartet itself. And that raises another point, and that is what brought the quartet together is not only a crisis, but their mutual concern that Ennahda and the Islamist party, or the semi-Islamist party, was obstructing progress. And what brought the four members of the quartet together was their shared suspicions of Ennahda. So this is a very political process. Let's not romanticize what was going on for one moment. This was a profoundly political process. And that, of course, is itself a mixed legacy. And then finally, I'd only sort of add one more point, and that is international forces did in the end play an important role. A pressure from France and the United States and from Algeria and from the EU got the leaders of Ennahda and Kaida Sepsi, who becomes president and leader of Nidat Tunis, the Call of Tunis party, together to talk about coming to an agreement. So international pressure in the end comes in. It's instigated from below. It's embedded in Tunisian soil. But at the right moment, the regional international forces play happily and perhaps in an exceptional way, a very positive role.
Dan, thank you. I had an additional question, but I see the time has run out, and I think we want to turn it over to Elizabeth so we can hear from the audience as well. But Ely, thank you. I had one question I wanted to ask you, but we'll save it for a private conversation later.
Sure. Well, in the case of Lebanon, I mean, the two dialogues in 2006 and 2008 had different power plays. In 2006, Syria was under huge international pressure after the assassination of former Prime Minister Hariri. Not only it was led by the US and the EU, but also there was a regional pressure from Egypt and some of the GCC countries. So definitely the Syrians had no other choice but to push their proxies in Lebanon to sit down and find an honorable way for the international tribunal that was in the process of being set up. I think that was the main motivation that allowed the dialogue to happen. And in terms of power, obviously the actors were Lebanese, so we didn't have any visible external power involved in the dialogue, but behind the scenes, the whole dialogue process was instrumentalized by regional and international powers. In 2008, it was different because the dialogue, as I said in the video, the dialogue came right after a military invasion of Beirut. So back then, Hezbollah had an interest in sitting down and negotiating a political arrangement, because they found out that this is the limit of how much they can do on the military level. While the second party, which is the anti-Hezbollah coalition, if I can call it like this, was basically a defeated one. So they saw in the dialogue as an opportunity to refresh, basically, or to reassert their presence, politically speaking. So, but again, in 2008, the role of the international community was much more obvious and visible. So Qatar was taking the lead, but with a very strong support from the United States, the EU, some GCC countries, obviously, and the League of Arab States. So the international powers were never absent from any of the rounds of the dialogues in Lebanon. Sometimes they were more visible than other times, but they were always the main proponents of the dialogue. Thank you.
Thank you, Lily. Elizabeth, back to you.
Thank you very much, Dan, and Lee, and Derek, and Penda, for your answers. I was really interested in how you raised the point that even though these dialogues had domestic conveners, the international community was in the background in the cases of Lebanon and Tunisia, influencing the players towards dialogue. I think there's a tendency to think that a dialogue is either convened domestically or internationally, but oftentimes it's a sort of hybrid that gets us to the place where the dialogue commences. I want to ask about public perceptions of these dialogues. This is as our audience questions are rolling in. But a burning question for me is public perceptions of these dialogues and how the public perceptions or the public legitimacy impacted the outcomes. So then this question is specifically for Dan and Ali, and then I have a related question for Penda. Dan, in Tunisia, we see that the dialogue very neatly achieved its four objectives, but it was an elite affair. And you note in your case study that the dialogue was sort of perceived as an act of political theater by some members of society, but it was difficult to assess the longer term impact of that. And I'm wondering now with a bit more time, if you have any comments on what it meant for Tunisia's politics, that this dialogue was an elite affair, how it was perceived and the long-term impacts of that. And similarly, Ali, for you, you very clearly explained that these dialogues, they provided, as Derek summarized, a safety valve in moments of crisis. They allowed a sort of partial easing of a crisis without a full resolution of the problems. And you also explained that it was some of the same players that were always in politics that were at these dialogues. What were people on the streets in Lebanon thinking of the dialogues, and how did those perceptions impact the dialogue's success in, you know, easing tensions, but at the same time, failure to sort of fully resolve a crisis? So let me go to Dan first on that, and then to Ali, please.
Well, great questions. We could have an entire conference on these questions. Very quickly, first of all, let's keep in mind that the four members, particularly the UGTT and the main organization representing business and the trade community, have large constituencies. It's a country of 11 million people. If you've got 600,000 in the labor union, that's, even though you're negotiating through elites, you're speaking for considerable constituencies. So in some sense, that gap was already bridged. But you're right. In the beginning of the dialogue, the various new emerging organizations are brought in, and there's a kind of elaborate theater where people sit down and they declare, and then the elites go and they actually do the real talking, right? And I think that, and as you well know, USAP supported a study of this from the ground up by Tunisian scholars, and they sat with civil society organizations, and they said, yeah, I mean, for us, eventually this was a kind of political theater. We don't feel we had the kind of input. And I think the legacy here is that in many respects, given the current disillusionment with the Tunisian politics from the ground up for many young people, politics is still seen as an elite affair. And the current president, Kais Saied, is manipulating and instrumentalizing this perception. And he said just the other day he dismissed the importance of the dialogue, which was, I thought, very unfair of him. But he's using this sort of public disillusionment to advance a populist strategy. Sounds familiar, I think. And in so doing, he's trying to sort of draw the lines of the initial dialogue to suggest it was completely sort of irrelevant. And that's quite unfair of him. But I'm not here to berate the Tunisian president. I'm only trying to say that the perception of this being an elite affair continues to endure and provides a background for a major question of Tunisian politics, and that is how and what way to link the political apparatus to the wider society.
Thanks. That is really interesting. And your depiction of the convening entity, the quartet, specifically the UGTT in Tunisia, is so interesting. I think we could do a whole other conference on conveners, and the uniqueness of Tunisia's case is really noteworthy. It's so interesting to hear that the fact that the dialogue was an elite affair is being brought up, what, 6-7 years post the dialogue.
Yeah.
So thanks for sort of bringing us up to the present on that. Ali, can I turn to you for this question now, please?
Sure. So in the case of Lebanon, the public perception of the dialogues is not really one of a political process. It's mostly a perception of a kind of a bargaining exercise that is happening between the elites who are controlling at the same time the political landscape and the business landscape, because the synergies, if I want to use a positive term, the synergies between business and politics in Lebanon are very high and very visible. So the public perception in general is one that is very skeptical, that looks at it as, you know, just a bargaining exercise to diffuse a crisis and then spend some time before the next crisis comes in. It was never looked at as a durable, as a political process that could lead to durable outcomes.
Thanks, Ali. That's really interesting to hear about the perceptions, and I see some parallels to the Tunisia experience in that case. I want to look at the Assise Nationale now and ask Hinda a question. And the Assise Nationale had a really unique origin for a national dialogue, and that was in the frustration of the opposition politicians after they had boycotted the elections. And you know, you and Emily describe in the case study that the dialogue began as an initiative of the opposition, but it seemed to bridge fairly quickly into a broader exercise that was able to be depoliticized and then welcome the participation of an enormously broad group of members of society. And so my question is what I'm saying accurate? Did the dialogue manage to become depoliticized from an opposition affair to a broadly inclusive one? Did it succeed in welcoming people, even those who were supportive of President Wade? And if so, how did that happen? How did the organizers manage to make the dialogue broadly appealing for many groups of society to participate?
Yes, I think that if what we can call the public perception of the Assise Nationale in Senegal is great, it's because this process was a success. The original idea was absolutely the idea of the political opposition, but when they went out to their coalition, they made a coalition. And they were, you know, doing the boycott of the legislative elections, etc. But the next question for them was to say, what else? What now? Because Abdoulaye Wade is still running, even if we don't recognize him as our president. What we have 5 years to deal with him. What to do next? And the idea was to go towards this national dialogue, but they couldn't do it by themselves. They had to bring people, legitimate people and organization with them. So they went and do what they call visits. They were out, you know, visiting representative of economic sector, seeing big NGOs, etc., and these remarkable people that people respect in Senegal, and mostly, you know, the religious people, and because, you know, we have this very strong brotherhood in the country, and people like Amadou Mahtambo, who have, you know, a very brilliant and exceptional trajectory. So they went out to their comfort zone, you know, political zone, and while they were doing these meetings, these visits with all these other groups, people come to them and tell them that they were interested in having this conversation, only if they were ready to discuss real and serious issues, and not only fighting Abdoulaye Wade's governance, but thinking about Senegalese trajectories, Senegalese problems, etc. So the civil society force, you know, the opposition to broaden the agenda and bring in this agenda new issues, including the way that the current opposition at that time used to govern. So they were going back to the 60s after independence, and they were questioning and addressing these whole issues. And that's why, that's at this turning point when they were capable of saying, telling to the people that they will address all these issues and do it in a right and left, you know, manner. That, you know, people were really interested and jumped, you know, in the process. Yeah, so they were just a part of the process at one point and not at the center. And they were, I would say, forced to make room, you know, for all these other people and all these other issues, other than only, you know, electoral matters or constitutions, etc. So.
Thanks very much, Penda. That your depiction of what is happening behind the scenes is so interesting, and to me, it really lays bare the fact that what happens before the dialogue during the preparatory phase is as crucial to the success as the dialogue itself, as the deliberations that happen within the dialogue. So thank you for walking us through how the dialogue went from an opposition affair to one that was perceived as more broadly inclusive and more broadly legitimate. We're going to get to audience questions in just a minute. I think that they're rolling in and being passed to me. I wanted to raise, since Penda has raised the question of the preparatory phase, I wanted to invite Eli and Dan to describe a little bit how the preparations happened behind the scenes, how it was possible to get these parties that were in such tremendous opposition to one another to the table, and how the conveners were able to use their leverage to do so. So could I ask Eli to comment on that first, the preparatory phase?
Yeah, well, I think in the case of the 2006 dialogue, there was more time to prepare for the dialogue compared to 2008. Most of the preparation was, as I said, it was instigated by international and regional powers, but was carried out actually by Lebanese political figures, who were, you know, even in the worst time of the civil war in Lebanon, these figures never stopped communicating amongst each other. So the communication existed at all times. We never had a complete disruption of communication between the key political figures in Lebanon. And what happened, as I described in the case study, is that the person who took the lead on this was the speaker, Nabih Birri. In 2006, he was the one who took the lead in talking to the different parties, you know, first raising the idea with them, then agreeing on participants, on the modalities, on the agenda, on the talking points, etc. So he took the lead, but he was definitely acting in the framework of this international and regional support that was provided to him. Thank you.
Thanks, Eli. Dan?
Well, I mean, it sounds a little ironic, but I suppose what led up to the dialogue was not so much a preparatory phase, but a series of somewhat failed efforts by other players to get dialogues going, including President Marzuki at the time. And each one sort of went only so far, but helped to sort of create the impetus for the dialogue itself. So in some sense, it wasn't formal preparation or even informal, but a series of efforts that each one sort of built on the other because the previous one didn't work out. I mean, let's put it in that way. Also, there was a crucial meeting in Paris between Ghannouchi and Essebsi, who later becomes president, and Ghannouchi being the leader, but not the party. pushed by the international community that basically said to these leaders, you get together, you come to an arrangement, you agree, and then you come back and you push this forward. And that really was crucial, because without these two antagonists coming to an agreement about the basic sort of premise of the idea of a negotiation, it would have been very difficult to have it. So that too was part of the process. So there were a series of different efforts led by political leaders that sort of helped set the stage without necessarily being part of a formal process to prepare for the specific dialogue that then emerged.
Thanks, Dan. I think a point that I really enjoyed from your case study is that we should consider Tunisia's national dialogue as Tunisia's national dialogues. The famous national dialogue got so much attention, and indeed it was such a success, but it's important to see all the processes that led up to it. And Ali, your depiction of Nabih Berri's ability to pull all of the parties to the table really speaks to the fact that the person who's convening needs to have that sort of leverage. So thank you both. I want to ask a question from the audience about the question of inclusion. An audience member asks, and this is a lot of questions into one, so I'd like to briefly give each of you a few minutes to speak on it. How can we foster dialogue given social exclusion in our communities? What techniques can be used? And what are the risks of leaving out groups who are already marginalized? So I'd like to go to Penda first on that, to speak to the Assis Nacional processes, because it was so broad, and then Dan and Ali as well, because I think there's questions about what an elite level dialogue does to groups that are already marginalized. So Penda, over to you, please, first.
Okay, how did they do to invite people and involve people in this dialogue? Actually, there were several mechanisms. The most popular one was these citizens' consultations, consisting in a kind of decentralization of the process. So the whole thing is not to think the dialogue in like something who has to happen in cities, in the capital, or in big hotels, etc. What they did is a very strong decentralization, working with local communities. And for example, schools were used to gather people because, you know, you have a school absolutely everywhere, you know. And there were, these were the space where people were gathered. But they were this kind of representative in each department, in each local area. So the process was really like a pyramidal one. They were everything was thought, you know, at the central level. But at some point, there was, you know, this decentralized process, and they use a lot what we call here radio communautaire. I don't know how to say it in English, but you know, these local radios, and you know, the discussions were diffused at the same time on the radio. So people were, you know, know what was happening, and they were invited to be there. So the idea that this is the first time that the floor is people, actually they just say to the people, the floor is yours. So you will have this expert going, you know, in these places, but saying to the people that they were here to listen and not even discuss with the people. They were there to let people talk, to hear what they were saying and engage in after that in conversations. I think that decentralization is something very, very important, and really inviting people through, you know, these meetings, but only, you know, through the web, through the internet. I was telling you that, you know, the diaspora played a major role, and they did it in these outside Senegal. That's very interesting. You know, the Assis were in the very, very local spaces, very central places like Dakar or Saint Louis, but at the same time in spaces outside the country, to because, you know, the issue of inclusivity were that every Senegalese men and women have to have the chance to say something. So that was the way they were thinking, and that's why the diaspora was brought in this process. So you had several layers, you know, and means to people were, for example, sending letters. You know, old people would write again, people would send emails, people would come and etc. So, you know, we have this massive data and archives around, you know, this participation, which and that's just amazing, the way that was the way that it was done to give people a chance, you know, to engage in this discussion.
Amanda, thank you. The architecture of the Assis Nacional is absolutely fascinating, and you've managed to provide us with so many specific techniques that can be used to counter exclusion. So thank you for those really concrete examples. I want to ask Ali to comment briefly on this. Ali, in your video message, you mentioned that that new approaches are needed to bring in youth and other non-traditional elites into the conversation in Lebanon. I know there were some civil society efforts around some of the national dialogues through the Common Space Initiative. Do you want to comment on any of those or more broadly ways to counter exclusion? I think you're on mute, Ali.
Sorry. Yeah, I was saying this is a very important element in the success of any dialogue. You know, inclusivity will definitely contribute to having more durable results or outcomes. The question is how to do it in a highly polarized landscape. If I may give an example from Libya, I mean, in our work as an institute in Libya, we are still facing a very strong pushback and resistance to including youngsters in any kind of political process, whether dialogue at the community level or otherwise. So this is just to tell you that there are cultural obstacles in the region to this kind of inclusion. I'm not saying this to say we should give up, but I'd like to make the point that it is not only a matter of design, it's a matter of feasibility. So you may well design a very nice and inclusive process. When it comes to implementation, you will face this cultural challenge that I just mentioned. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ali. Dan, any thoughts on how to counter exclusion in the
future? Ali put his finger on the issue, which is questions of feasibility. Tunisia has a large marginalized community in the West and the South. There's no doubt about it. It's the privileged elites along the northern coast that are critical and help to play the role. But interestingly enough, now we've seen in Tunisia an emergence of the last few months, a whole series of new groups, many of which come from the marginalized communities, which are really pushing to be included in a new national dialogue. And and I do not see any obstacle to that happening if the political elites who are now sort of in charge of Tunisia, including the president himself, would be open to such inclusion. So a lot will rest on the political will and capacity of elites to take advantage of the opportunity of such groups that are militating for inclusion to invite them in. And so we're now at a point now where perhaps the kinds of inclusion that was not possible at the beginning, because in the beginning you had to get an agreement and get it quick, is possible. But we also see that a number of elites that are part of the political apparatus and the power structure are not facilitating this. So a lot has to do with the political will and readiness of elites to take advantage of opportunities to promote inclusion.
Thanks very much, Dan. We're going to wrap up our first panel here. As we conclude, I'm really struck by how much our understanding of national dialogues has evolved over these past 10 years. When 10 years ago, we might have thought that this national dialogues would be sort of the be-all and end-all of conflict resolution. And I think now we have more of an understanding of how there are so many processes that complement national dialogues, and how we can learn from peace processes, from negotiations for our national dialogues, and how we can take our insights from national dialogues and apply them to other governance and peace processes. I want to sincerely thank Derek, Penda, Ali, and Dan. It was a wonderful panel. I wish we could stay here all day, but I'm likewise so excited for our second panel. So I want to encourage our audience to take a 5-minute break, and we'll be right back with our second panel on international involvement in national dialogues. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Good morning, good afternoon. I'm pleased to welcome you to the second panel for today's event on national dialogues hosted by the United States Institute of Peace and the Peace Appeal Foundation. My name is Susan Stigant, and I'm the director of the Africa Program at the United States Institute of Peace. Today's discussion draws on USIP's recent publication, National Dialogues in Peacebuilding and Transitions, Creativity and Adaptive Thinking. The publication examines dialogues in 6 countries: the Central African Republic, Kenya, Lebanon, Senegal, Tunisia, and Yemen. It draws on the experience and expertise and insight of those who were involved in designing the dialogues: diplomats, participants, delegates, academic observers, assistance providers, and those who have supported them in other ways. These experiences show the possibilities for fostering dialogue, forging agreements, strengthening inclusion, and driving towards peace. And the report offers guidance on the possibilities and practicalities for those considering convening a national dialogue. In our first panel, we heard from authors of the case studies on Senegal, Tunisia, and Lebanon, and focused discussion on inclusion in national dialogues. In the second panel, we are joined by authors and experts on the experiences with national dialogues in Kenya, Yemen, and the Central African Republic. We will focus our discussion on the role of international partners and international engagement. So why look at international engagement? When USIP began to look at national dialogues and their promise as an approach for peace building, questions about international engagement came up in several different ways. At the time, efforts were underway or being explored in Sudan and Libya, and recent success in Tunisia and hope in Yemen fueled hope for a commitment to a stronger, more sustainable way towards inclusive settlements. From those who were leading the design of national dialogues and governments where they were being contemplated, we heard very clearly about the sacred, sovereign nature of a national dialogue and the core questions about the state, the relationship between citizens and government that were being contemplated. At the same time, we heard a tension, in some instances, with the desire for international recognition of the process and the outcomes, as well as the desire for financial and technical support. We also heard from those who were leading or designing dialogues a recognition that beyond designing inclusion, the agenda, the mediation, the facilitation, the logistics, the operations, that they also recognized that international engagement had to be managed. This meant leveraging international partners who could influence towards a credible, sustainable agreement. It also meant mitigating the risk that some international partners might interfere or inhibit agreements. Finally, we heard from our colleagues in the US and other governments from the United Nations and other multilateral institutions who were puzzling to determine what their roles should be. When and how should foreign governments provide financial support? What, if anything, should foreign governments say in public diplomacy or quiet engagement? How can foreign governments or partners continually assess whether national dialogues are making progress towards meaningful peace or solidifying divisions, power, or even violence? Today, we have an excellent panel to help us to explore some of these complicated questions from the experiences that they have delved into. We will hear their initial reflections through a series of pre-recorded remarks, and then we will open up for a conversation and hope to bring any of our live viewers into the discussion. You're welcome to submit any questions through USIP's event page. You can also send questions or join the conversation via Twitter using the hashtag National Dialogues. So let me briefly introduce our panelists, and then we will turn to hearing their initial remarks. Jimmy Ochieng is a social scientist who focuses on governance, political communication, public opinion, political engagement, mediation support, and reconciliation. He has consulted for the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue, the United Nations, and the Birkhoff Foundation. He is currently a graduate in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at the University of Nairobi. We're also joined by Erika Gaston, who is a non-resident fellow with the Global Public Policy Institute in Berlin and a PhD candidate at the University of Cambridge. Previously, she's led USIP's law portfolios in Afghanistan and Yemen and designed programming related to traditional dispute resolution, women's access to justice, land conflict and rights. Erika is the lead case study author on Yemen. Finally, we're joined by Rachel Sullivan, who is a program specialist with the Africa Center at USIP, where she coordinates initiatives in the Central African Republic. Rachel co-authored the publication on CAR. So let's turn now to hear from our panelists.
The Yemen National Dialogue was viewed as the hope of the post-Arab Spring process. It was a way for Yemen to engage in a holistic political settlement that it would allow it to overcome longstanding political, regional, and tribal divisions and come out of the bloodshed that had really taken over the country in 2011. It was an enormous process vested with tons of energy, both by Yemenis and by internationals. There were more than 500 delegates from across the political spectrum, political parties, tribes, all regions, civil society, youth, women. They came together, they deliberated for nearly a year on every imaginable type of proposal or issue: healthcare, retirement, the federal structure of the state, women's rights, transitional justice. In the end, they came up with some 1,800 recommendations touching every type of reform possible. But as the dialogue went on, the Yemeni state was already slipping into further conflict. And ultimately, although the dialogue came in with high ambitions and high hopes, it was not enough to overcome some of the structural factors and political divisions that had racked Yemen. So the Yemen National Dialogue was really a departure in terms of the way that it brought such a diverse range of Yemeni society around the table, and in terms of the sort of issues that it tried to tackle. It really did set a landmark in terms of saying that it was equally important to pay attention to some of the military and security issues and issues like women's rights, like health, like transitional justice. But in the end, a lot of the key factions who had long contested the Yemeni government did not buy into the dialogue and did not participate from the onset. Some of those that did were already sort of opting out as the dialogue was going on, and conflict was escalating in the north with the Houthis, even as the ink was drying on the paper. Ultimately, in the end, the capacity of the delegates to offer recommendations and to come to their own internal accord proved to be greater than that of the Yemeni government to actually implement them. Conflict between key factions escalated even as the conclusions were being signed, and Yemen slipped into civil war within 6 months with almost no possibility to implement any of them. It's not clear that this certainly was not the fault of the Yemeni National Dialogue, but in retrospect, the fact that so much energy and time was spent on this large-scale dialogue at a time when there were so many other crucial security and political issues to be dealt with and sort of fraying at the seams may have been a costly distraction. The international community was a big part of Yemen's transition process and specifically of the national dialogue. So the Gulf Cooperation Council and the countries that are part of it, as well as the US and a number of European countries, were key mediators helping to broker an initial peace agreement and a political settlement and negotiation process that brought Yemen out of the conflict in 2011 that had followed its Arab Spring process. And they were equally involved in the national dialogue process from the initial preparatory phase through to providing the financial support for the dialogue, as well as any additional support that the Yemeni government might need to conduct outreach on the national dialogue, help with any of the technical facilitation or preparation for trying to implement it. So the international community certainly played a huge role, and the national dialogue would not have happened without the support of these different international actors. The Yemeni community and the Yemeni public initially really supported this international intervention. They recognized that it was helpful to have international mediators, that it was crucial to breaking some of the political divides. However, as the national dialogue went on, it started to have this reputation as almost a an international, you know, almost a too formal process that was prized by internationals, but how much was it really delivering for the Yemeni public? So it was held at the Movenpick Hotel, this very fancy hotel, and each of the members of the National Dialogue received a large stipend, and they would just say that it was the Movenpick negotiations. In addition, there was a critique that the international community really wanted this flagship process and were pushing it even when the necessary ingredients were not there or when there were other potential priorities going on in Yemen. So one of the key omissions in the dialogue was that many of the southern delegates, you know, South Yemen used to be its own state and they went, some constituencies still seek independence, and many of those did not buy into the process, and it was the international community, in particular the UN, the US, a lot of the members of the GCC, who pushed for the national dialogue to go forward, even though some of the prerequisite conditions demanded by southern delegates had not been satisfied. And so certainly that haste to get to this formal process over a tension of whether the conditions were right on the ground might have been some of the factors that led to the dialogue's failure. On paper, the Yemen National Dialogue was the gold standard. It met the blueprint for what you would want for a national dialogue process. It was inclusive, it was representative, it covered every sort of issue that you would want to have to renegotiate a political settlement. But it didn't have all the right people around the table. It was so large and unwieldy that it was impossible for a struggling state to implement all of those negotiations. And ultimately, it didn't keep pace with the facts on the ground, which were unraveling even as they were making progress at the table. So to have a national dialogue really work, it has to be synced in with what's going on around it.
The Kenyan National Dialogue and Reconciliation Process was set up in 2008 in response to the unprecedented violence that followed the disputed 2007 presidential elections between the Party of National Unity, led by Mwai Kibaki, and the Orange Democratic Movement, led by Raila Odinga. The violence led to the death of 1,113 people and displacement of more than 600,000. The purpose of KNDR was to end the violence that was threatening to spiral out of control and find solutions to constitutional and institutional reforms. Four agenda items guided the process: immediate action to stop violence and restore fundamental rights and liberties, measures to address the humanitarian crisis, promote reconciliation, healing, and restoration, how to overcome the political crisis, and getting to the root causes of long-term issues and solutions. The African Union Chair, John Kufuor, convinced the disputants to agree to a negotiated solution supported by the African Union panel of eminent African personalities led by Kofi Annan, Benjamin Mkapa, and Grasa Machel. The principals appointed four representatives each to the negotiations. The negotiation phase, which started on 29th January 2008, ended after 41 days and finalized agenda items 1 to 3, leading to the formation of a grand coalition government. The African Union panel of eminent personalities worked together with the African Union, the United Nations, Center for Humanitarian Dialogue, and diplomatic missions to convince the parties to agree to a ceasefire and embark on a dialogue. There are a number of roles that the international community played. One, it was able to provide a platform for other actors to be able to participate in the negotiation and implementation phase. Two, it was also able to assist the country to set up key institutional and legal reforms, which led to the establishment of a new electoral body and other strong institutions that could be able to withstand the stresses and shocks of government interference. More importantly, it was also able to help build a culture in dialogue exchanging, which made it possible to later allow two key principal actors to initiate a dialogue process after the contested 2017 elections. External assistance was very constructive in one, getting the parties to agree to only one mediation process and avoid forum shopping. Kofi Annan, upon arriving in the country, insisted that his process was the only one that the two parties would subscribe to in order for the country to be able to have a negotiated solution to the crisis. Second, the parties also carried out the implementations because the international community made it possible for them to be able to have the necessary technical and financial support to oversee the implementation process. Thirdly, external assistance was also able to provide a platform for other stakeholders, especially civil society, to engage in the process and give views on how best the crisis will be resolved. More importantly, at the end of the negotiation phase, the panel of eminent African personalities engaged throughout the implementation process through the Coordination and Liaison Office, periodic visits to the country, and annual conferences that did a stock-taking of how the implementation was being carried out. In addition, the team that was in charge of negotiation was also transformed into a dialogue team that was able to oversee implementation. Considering that these members were appointed to the cabinet, made it easy for them to guide the implementation process. However, there was one shortcoming when it comes to external assistance. The Party of National Unity felt that their involvement in the country's negotiation process infringed on the sovereignty of Kenya and would occasionally try to find a way to avoid fully implementing the agreements reached. There are a number of lessons that we can draw from the support provided by external actors and the way the KNDR agreements were implemented. First, the right people for the job. The stature of the panel members made it easy for them to reach out to the international community to provide the needed support and also help to move the process whenever it stalled. Two, the international community was united behind a single process and spoke with one voice. This made it possible to consistently influence the way the parties responded to the implementation process. Third, the international community accompanied the implementation phase from the beginning to the end, providing the necessary technical and financial support to implement constitutional and institutional reforms. There was also the issue of ensuring that the timeframes which had been agreed on were adhered to up to the end, and an independent firm was given the task of monitoring how the implementation was taking place and provide feedback whenever there was a slowdown of momentum. Lastly, the inclusion of the public and key stakeholders through regular briefings in the media, through meeting and engaging with civil society, getting their input and providing feedback, and also through the parties engaging their constituents on how the process was unfolding.
The national dialogue process in the Central African Republic was composed of three parts: a ceasefire agreement, popular consultations, and the Bangui National Forum. The national dialogue itself was proposed as a solution to decades of conflict that had escalated in 2013 to a violent coup d'etat where a group of armed rebels from the north came and seized control of the government. Retaliatory violence between these rebels and self-defense groups that came to be known as the Anti-Balaka eventually escalated into an ethnic cleansing of the minority Muslim population. The international community, concerned about what it saw as an increasing trend in violence and in particular atrocities against civilians, intervened and pressured the rebel government to step down in favor of a transitional government. The transitional government was tasked with leading the Central African Republic back to constitutional and elected government. Part of their journey was to put on a national dialogue process, which started with a ceasefire agreement between the transitional government and the armed groups, and then moved into the popular consultation phase where citizens around the country were invited to give their views on not only what caused the conflict, but the best ways forward. These were fed then into a national level dialogue that took place in the capital, Bangui, which resulted in a Republican Pact for Peace, a report that took together all of the different perspectives and laid out specific recommendations to bring the country back to constitutional governance and laid the foundations for building peace in the country. The outcomes of the Central African Republic's national dialogue were mixed. On the one hand, there were some really good immediate outcomes that helped people be more involved in their peace process. On the other hand, there were some negative outcomes that were related to struggles with the implementation of the agreement, and a lot of that had to do with pressure to then move into the national elections. So on the positive side, some of the outcomes included the official recognition of Muslim holidays, which is a big deal for a minority population that had been targeted by a lot of the violence.